ladies and gentlemen, welcome to Histories of the Unexpected, the show in which we demonstrate how everything, simply everything, you can possibly think of has its own history, like owls, brown sauce, and triumph.
I was particularly pleased with those three, yeah, Sam. Me too. I thought that's they were a cracker. Excellent. I want to do the history of brown sauce. Okay. Or we could do figs, wigs, and oil rigs, jigs, pigs, and gigs. I think the history of gigs would be fascinating, but that would delay us monstrously, as always, because we will be following the links in our minds as we come across them, explaining very carefully indeed how those histories link together in unexpected ways. Who knew, for example, Sam, who knew that the history of donkeys is in fact all about A.A. Milne, Eeyore and the history of gloom, World War One and military transportation, nativities and childhood memories. It's all about cheesy Italian-American Christmas songs. It's about the architecture of medieval cities. And it's about, of course, the journey from Nazareth to Bethlehem and dragons at the birth of Jesus. Did you know, somebody said this week that they'd never read any A.A. Milne before in their lives. But if they read... if they listen to it, they would only listen to it if I read the voice of Eeyore, having heard our episode. Isn't that lovely?
It was
so
very good.
Thank you for whoever said that. Or who knew that the history of poison is in fact all about 18th century shopkeepers, assassination attempts on Elizabeth I, Roman women and the history of bread. It's also all about Venice and powdered diamonds, weed killer and the history of horticulture. Did you know that, Sam?
Yeah, the powdered diamonds one, really, I was astonished at that. Quite regularly, making histories of the unexpected, I am astonished by things. And the powdered diamonds in the history of poison did astonish me. Ladies and gentlemen, you're probably wondering who is telling you all of these fascinating facts. Let me tell you of my fellow presenter that if history was a fantastical being, none less than Ilúvatar, this man would be the most powerful of his firstborn children, the elves, making him the most powerful of the most powerful, far more so than mere men or dwarves. Yes, he is the king of the elves himself, distinguished by his near immortality. James, I think you've been in your 40s for far too long. He is... of course, the professor extraordinaire of early modern British history at Plymouth University. He is the immortal James Daywell.
Oh, Sam, I think I'd quite like to be immortal. I think that would be quite challenging, though, I imagine. You may well be wondering who is that unattributed voice so ably helping Daybell co-pilot these episodes. Well, let's just say that if he were an elf-related historian, he'd only be the jolly old elf himself, Father Christmas from Twas the Night Before Christmas. So full of festive historical cheer is he, so generous and fearless is he in battling through all weathers, across time zones, through torrents, through blizzards, through blazes, through snowstorms, in order to fill the stockings of the past for only good girls and boys. Yes, you've guessed it. It's the famous historical adventurer, Dr. Sam Willis.
Hello, everyone. Lovely to be here again in our festive series. If you haven't clocked it yet, guys, we tend to do lots of festive themes during the Christmas period on Histories of the Unexpected. We're doing loads this year. We started off with donkeys. We've done some wonderful stuff. And also back in the past, so go back through our back catalogue where there are some really tremendous episodes in and around Christmas, which are there for you to enjoy. Today, we are doing elves or elfs. Elves. It's one that James has come up with, and I loved this one. And I learned lots of new and interesting things, James.
I learned lots of new and interesting things all about elves. And my starting point was, of course, the popular culture of elves that we have today. If you think about the film Elf, a brilliant film, and I think I talked about that in one of our recent podcasts, which is a real Daybell family tradition. But elves crop up all over the place at the moment. Santa Claus the Movie with Patch the Elf, played by a brilliant Dudley Moore. The Elf on a Shelf that my daughter had a friend come over for a sleepover this weekend and brought an elf on the shelf. I gather these are sort of rather sort of tricksy creatures that you put around the house and they do naughty things. Elf Yourself is a brilliant app at this time of year where if any of you haven't done it, you should do it because you can take pictures of you and your friends and then turn yourselves into dancing elves. My favourite being the hip-hop elves that we did last year. I don't know whether you saw that, Sam, but I put yours and my face on hip-hop elves. I'm sure you appreciated it. So there are all sorts of things we can do with the history of elves. Elves are supposed to be in Father Christmas's workshop, Santa's workshop, helping him beaver away and not only looking after reindeer, but also producing all of the toys. So one of the things that I'm going to be doing is have a look at some of the early history of elves. But also there may be a little Tolkien along the way. Tolkien, a big writer about elves, and his friendship with C.S. Lewis while they were at interwar and post-war Oxford. And there's some really interesting stuff that I'm going to tell you about there. And also, I'm going to read some from David Sedaris's Santaland Diaries, where he has a story or a description of himself being a Macy's store elf for the season when he was younger and trying to break it through in New York as a writer.
Very good. Should we start with Tolkien, James? Because I came across some great Tolkien stuff. Well, I didn't also come across it. It was the first thing that came to mind.
Oh, and tell us about your stuff about Tolkien.
Well, I mean, I remember it's quite kind of an important part in my history as well, my own literary history, because I vividly remember reading The Hobbit and The Lord of the Rings, and those being the first books that contained made-up languages that I'd ever read. And I was entranced by it. I loved it. And you should all know that Elvish in The Hobbit and The Lord of the Rings is a proper language that Tolkien made up. He was a professor of language studies at Oxford, philology. And it wasn't the first language that he made up. The first language he made up when he was a kid, and his mum made him throw it away because she didn't think there was going to be any use in it. So he literally had to destroy the manuscripts of the language that he made up. And perhaps he then used it again when he made up Elvish. But you can hear him. There are audio accounts of Tolkien talking in Elvish as well. But this is someone who he could speak Middle English, and he could read the Icelandic and the Nordic, one of those wonderful Eddas and poems, which I also want to talk about. So anyway, I just thought that was quite interesting, James, that he'd made up a language and it resonated with a part of my history. But another thing about Tolkien, as you say, he was friends with C.S. Lewis at Oxford, but he served in the First World War. This is when all of this is happening. It's the early 20th century, and he was inventing the elves. I suspect he might have been thinking about it when he was on watch in the trenches. He was at the Somme. He suffered very badly from trench fever, and a lot of his mates and his colleagues died in 1916. He came home. He recuperated. It was when he recuperated that he started writing a book called The Silmarillion. And if you're into your Tolkien, then that is the one. It's the one that he thought was his best. But the publishers loved The Hobbit, published it. This is after this is like 1930s, The Hobbit, late 1930s it was published. 37, interestingly, so also around the time of war, 1937. And then subsequently, he wrote The Silmarillion, but the publishers said, not so good, can you please write another one that involves more hobbits? So he wrote back immediately and said he'd just started a new chapter, which then went on to become The Lord of the Rings. So Tolkien, an interesting one, because it makes you think about the history of making up languages. What did you think about Tolkien, James?
Oh, that's lovely. Well, I mean, I also remember reading The Hobbit and Lord of the Rings. The Hobbit I read when I was quite young. I was probably about 10, and I really loved it. I found it very, very moving. And I think, like you, it was one of the first times when I was introduced to fantasy fiction. I found The Lord of the Rings a bit of a struggle, I must admit. I read it later in life, and I had always heard that it was one of those books that one should read. So I sat down one holiday, and I was away in St. Ives, and I made myself read about 150 pages a day. And by about day four, I just had enough. I got to Tom Bombadil, and I was just not particularly interested. And it was more of a chore. I think if I'd read it now, I'd probably enjoy it much more. I've loved the films. I certainly haven't read The Silmarillion, which I think is quite dry. It doesn't have the sort of excitement. But I think one of the things
it's like an index. It's a bit weird.
I think
a long appendices.
Yes, and I think that's
a long appendix.
Long appendix sounds like a medical complaint, doesn't it?
I've got a long appendix. Definitely.
I think one of the things is he didn't just create languages, but he also created histories. So in the Silmarillion, that was what he was detailing. He was detailing these sort of previous histories of the elves. And I think that's where you have the staple of his construction of the elves. But as a scholar of Middle English, he was familiar with all sorts of ancient medieval texts that talked about elves. And I read a brilliant book, The Road to Middle Earth, which you can buy in paperback by a scholar called Tom Shippey. It was first published in 1982, and there was a more recent film tie-in version that came out in 2005 to tie in with the Lord of the Rings trilogy, the Peter Jackson things. And this is really good because what it does is it looks in a very academic way at the backdrop to the footnotes, really, to Tolkien and where he was getting his ideas from elves from. And there is a poetic fragment from the South English legendary from about 1250 that describes elves, that Shippey says that, you know, Tolkien must have been aware of this because it's very similar to the way in which he writes about elves. And often shaped like women on many secret paths, men see great numbers of them dancing and sporting. These are called elves, and often they come to town, and by day they are much in the woods. By night, up on the high downs, these are the wretched spirits that were taken out of heaven, and at doomsday many of them shall come to rest. And I think one of the things, the extraordinary things, is that if you have a look at the medieval literature as a philologist, there are lots of contradictory traditions about the elves. So if you know that are seen in Old English texts such as Beowulf, about the poet speaks of strange Ilf and Orkneys, Ettins, which is giants and elves and demon corpses. So these are, you know, quite evil creatures that are there. And Christian sources from Icelandic disapproved of these kinds of, you know, of these kinds of beings. But there are more positive descriptions of them, such as in Anglo-Saxon, a fair woman is known as Elf Beautiful. That's the Elfsin, Elf Beautiful. But there are also other legends that see the place where elves live as something, as a place that is dangerous to mortals, that distorts time, rather like Tolkien's Lothlorien. When they go there, they completely lose track of time. And I think when we're talking about elves and Tolkien's description of them, he is fusing together various different classical traditions of elves. And I think for them, he thinks of elves and dwarves very much as allegorical figures. And I think this comes through in discussions that he had with C.S. Lewis about elves. He sent Lewis a poem, and I just want to read you a few brief lines of this poem in which he talked about elves. Great powers, they slowly roared out of themselves, and looking backward, they beheld the elves that wrought upon cunning forges in the mind and light and the dark on secret looms entwined. And I think for him, seeing the world enchanted is part of seeing the world correctly. It's part of the world as mythology. So, you know, there was, you know, while it was mythical, there was also that it actually allowed you to study the world in a more correct way. He sees no stars who does not see them first, of living silver made that sudden burst of flame, like flowers beneath an ancient song. So in other words, this sort of mythical view that he's putting forward is part of human perception. And it's absolutely integral to the way in which people view life. So it's very much coming from a folklore tradition here. So there we are. I'm fascinated by those kind of sort of mythical medieval elves. And, you know, Tolkien, love him or hate him, is certainly a great source for studying them, Sam.
Absolutely. And it's really interesting the fact that if you think about, I asked myself at the beginning, what is an elf? How do I feel about elves? Are they good or are they bad? And there is it's really quite confusing. If you think about what you've been inspired by and how you understand elves, you think about it in contemporary literature. So Tolkien's elves, they're good generally, aren't they? They're wise, they're noble, they're immortal. So some have argued that he was a very devout Catholic, and whether he was actually trying to imagine what the earth would have been like before, after all, if there hadn't have been the fall, if this was like the purest example of what humanity could have been. But anyway, you can't get away from the fact of how clever and wise and noble and ageless and attractive and sort of wonderful they are. Terry Pratchett, another source of elves, James, for me. Certainly, you think I was reading The Hobbit when I was a kid, and then when I was a teenager reading Terry Pratchett. And his elves are different. They're really, really naughty. They're distinguished by their naughtiness and their threat that they pose to Discworld. And then I suppose the next stage in my elf life of reading stories is when I had kids and I read J.K. Rowling, where you've got another type of elf. You've got Dobby, which is a completely different sort of thing, quite subservient, and has various aspects to Dobby being this house elf, which are certainly drawn from Germanic myth. All to do with the giving of gifts. So you end up with three extremely different types of elves. You've got Tolkien's, you've got Pratchett's, and you've got J.K. Rowling's. And as you were mentioning there, actually, they've all kind of drawn on the creation of their elves from history. But that ambiguity of what an elf is very much matched in history. So whether it's in the Icelandic texts or in Anglo-Saxon words, you mentioned a couple, there are others. We've got some wonderful ones. Alfred itself, meaning elf wisdom. Helfbort, meaning elf bright. Elfnoth, meaning elf valour. These are all pretty good and positive things. But at the same time, there are a number of other words which exist in Anglo-Saxon, which definitely link elves to bad luck, to harmful magic, to sickness, and to nightmares in particularly. There are other examples as well in Romanian beliefs and also in Scandinavian folklore. So there's a real mix, a real ambiguity about what exactly an elf is, James. And it's represented as clearly in the original historical sources as it is in modern literature.
Oh, lovely. Let me take you from there and just explore some of those Scandinavian origins, because I think they're fascinating. I think, Sam, one of the interesting things to think about is how those ideas about elves formulate in Scandinavia and then move over to North America by migration. And what's interesting in the Scandinavian version, origin of elves, is the way in which they are associated with supernatural figures connected to the farm, and they're farm guardians. So the Tomten are these sort of farm guardians, and they're very similar to the British Brownie or Dobby or Hob. Tomter means homestead man, for example. And these creatures, these mythical...
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Creatures are associated with the winter solstice and the Christmas season, and over time they become associated with St. Nicholas in Sweden. So we all know St. Nicholas as the sort of precursor to Father Christmas. But you know, prior to St. Nicholas in Sweden, the gifts were given out by the Yule goat, would you believe? And it's not until the last decade of the 19th century that St. Nicholas sort of, you know, takes over, transplants the goat, and basically becomes associated with Christmas. And that's when he gets associated with the elves. But before that, these elves are also associated with the Yule goat. And they often accompany him. The pair of them sort of appear on Christmas Eve, knocking on doors, giving out presents. And then that tradition gets sort of Disneyfied and commercialised. And then what we see is Santa's little helpers become much more well-established in the literature of the United States in particular. And one of the first people to mention Christmas elves was Louisa May Alcott in her book Christmas Elves, which was finished in 1855. We know this because she refers to it in her journal with the phrase "finished fairy book in September," and "October May illustrated my book and tales called Christmas Elves, better than flower fables. Now I must try to sell it." And it seems that there, although she had a manuscript for this, a publisher was never found. So this is a book that had never saw the light of day in printed form. But then there are various other examples of Santa's elves cropping up in literature. Now, well, the next episode that we see is in 1857 in Harper's Weekly, in a poem called "The Wonders of Santa Claus," and I just want to read you a little extract from this. "Beyond the ocean, many a mile and many a year ago, there lived a wonderful queer old man in a wonderful house of snow. And every little boy and girl, as Christmas Eves arrive, no doubt will be very glad to hear the old man is still alive. In his house upon the top of a hill, and almost out of sight, he keeps a great many elves at work, all working with all their might, to make a million of pretty things, cake, sugar, plums and toys, to fill the stockings hung up, you know, by the little girls and boys. It would be a capital treat, be sure, a glimpse of his wondrous shop. But the queer old man, when a stranger comes, orders every elf to stop, and the house and work and workmen all instantly take a twist, and just you may think you are there, they are off in a frosty mist." And then in 1876, Louisa May Alcott returns to writing about Santa's elves. Having failed to publish her earlier book, she writes a poem entitled "Merry Christmas," and I just want to read you a couple of lines from this. "In the rush of early morning, when the red burns through the grey, and the wintry world lies waiting for the glory of the day, then we hear a fitful rustling just without upon the stair, see two small white phantoms coming, catch the gleam of sunny hair. Are they Christmas fairies stealing rows of little socks to fill? Are they angels floating hither with their message of goodwill? What sweet spell are these elves weaving as their larks they chirp and sing? Are these palms of peace from heaven that these lovely spirits bring? Rosy feet upon the threshold, eager faces peeping through, with the first red ray of sunshine, chanting cherubs come in view. mistletoe and gleaming holly, symbols of a blessed day, in their chubby hands they carry, streaming all along the way. Well, we know them never weary of this innocent surprise, waiting, watching, listening always, with full hearts and tender eyes, while our little household angels, white and golden in the sun, greet us with their sweet old welcome. Merry Christmas, everyone. So there we are, Sam. Some knowledge for you all about Christmas elves.
Let's talk about the elf on the shelf.
Oh, go on then.
I've got issues with the elf on the shelf.
I know very little about the elf on the shelf, except that I've seen it all over the place and I have rejected it as far too commercial.
Right, so that's interesting. Right, first up, it's new. Okay, it's a new Christmas tradition. And it hasn't, certainly wasn't around when I was a kid. It's fairly new. It's been around, I suppose, in the last 5 years, maybe less than that, that actually it's really started to happen. So the principle behind this, as far as I understand it, is that there is an elf that you put somewhere, like a shelf, and you move it around every day. And your children, you tell your children that the elf is watching them. And that if there is any bad behaviour involved, the elf will then report back to Father Christmas, who will take that into consideration when deciding on whether you've been naughty or nice, and therefore will decide whether or not to have have any presents. So, did you know that side of it, James?
I did know that side of it, and I thought that was terrible.
It is terrible, isn't it? It encourages children to stop and think about it. It encourages children to live with surveillance.
Yes.
And to be happy with surveillance. And it also teaches them that good behaviour, the behaviour is linked with some non-specific reward far in the future, which may or may not come. So what it actually is it's the threat of having a reward taken away. So it's the opposite of doing something good and being rewarded for it quickly. Like in the way you might train a dog, but you know, sit down, you give him a sweetie, absolutely fine. But kids are a bit like that as well. I am a parent, but I wouldn't say I'm an expert on parenting, but certainly rewarding children spontaneously for doing something good is a much better way than threatening them to take something away if they don't do something good. And that's entirely what the elf on the shelf is. It's also, before I get off my very high elf horse here, it's all part of what I call the big lie, James, which is remarkably similar to what's going on in America at the minute. But just bear with me. The big Santa lie. Okay, so
that Willis, that needed to come with a warning.
No, it's fine. It's fine. It's good. And this is really important, I think, because it is we're historians, right? And we need to encourage both creative thinking, but also critical thinking. Okay, you have to question stuff, and if you encourage people to believe in things without questioning it at all, you just believe in it just because it is so. That's profoundly ahistorical. And what you need to be doing is encouraging people to question it. And actually, I'd be hugely proud if a 4-year-old, 5-year-old said, "Worm, hang on a minute. Maybe it's not possible that a man in a giant sleigh can go all around the world delivering people's presents." So anyway, this all comes down to being able to exercise your imagination within a certain kind of structure. And to exercise your imagination, you have to have a starting point that something isn't true, right? And therefore, you can then pretend that it is true for a brief amount of time. It's like playing in the garden if you're watching Star Wars, whatever. You know there are no... I mean, the kids know that there are not, huge spaceships in the sky and people living on different planets. But you can go into the garden and you can pretend that once you've established the fact that it doesn't happen, right? Same with Christmas. And so surely the most healthy thing to do is to say, of course, the elf is not going to spy on you and it's not going to report back to Santa, and Santa can't deliver lots of toys and he probably won't fit down the chimney and we live in an apartment block and hasn't got a chimney anyway, blah, blah, blah. However, on this given day, we are going to pretend that that is the case. And I think that's a kind of a more healthy way of doing it. Anyway, it all links to a really interesting history of beliefs and how and when and where people actually believe in things. And we talked a lot about the Vikings and the Nordic traditions. I mean, Iceland in particular, they have a huge belief in elves and hidden people. And there's been recent studies done showing that actually there are only something like... It's only a handful of people in Iceland actually believe that these elves exist, that these hidden people exist. But that number would have changed over time. And it's exactly the same thing, whatever you were talking about in terms of myths and legends, that the belief in something actually existing over time will fundamentally change. And you can apply that to religion as well. You can apply that to anything that requires some measure of faith to believe in, which has, of course, its own history. So you can plot belief in things that do or do not exist. And there are some wonderful accounts of people genuinely believing that elves or whatever it might be have had something to do. I came across a wonderful example from 1950s in America. It's in the Journal of American Folklore. I won't read the whole thing out for you now, it's too long. But fair to say, there's a bit of chaos going on inside a barn. And this is the late 19th century, and it is genuinely put down to the grandmother puts it down to the possibility of there being a malicious creatures at work causing trouble within the barn. That was 1950s America. And whether she was doing it tongue-in-cheek, telling her children, who knows, or whether it was a true belief. But it stands to make the point that we may question or believe in the elf on the shelf and in Santa, but there's a much broader history here of believing in things which require faith to believe in.
Excellent, Sam Willis. Excellent. Yeah, I think that whole world of superstition yeah. Is a fascinating one. And it makes me think of Keith Thomas's Religion and the Decline of Magic, which is basically a book about the Reformation, but also and popular religion, but also showing all these sort of beliefs that people had that existed, coexisted side by side Christianity. So I think that's a really fascinating way of looking at that. It strikes me that the elf on the shelf is actually aping a tradition already very much in place about the naughty list, you know, and the good or bad children which parents use in order to control their children more broadly.
It's literally like the Stasi.
It is.
If you remove the fact there's a cuddly green elf and there is a list of good or bad, you could be in revolutionary Russia. French Revolution, you could be in East Germany, all of these dictatorial regimes who are spying on you and they are making up lists.
Yes, but what we have here is an elf doing it in a very sinister way. Well, I want to end with some of my Christmas reading that I've been doing, Santaland Diaries by David Sedaris, and it's a collection of stories. I've talked to you about it in previous episodes. I'm going to talk to you a little bit about it when we do our next episode, which is on babies. And the first chapter is Santaland Diaries, which gives its title to its name to the title of the book, and it's basically about David Sedaris, who's a very funny American writer, a time when he's in his early 30s, he's 33 years old, and he goes for an interview at Macy's, a big department store in New York. Think of it a bit like the department store that the film Elf is based in with Zooey Deschanel. And anyway, he goes along, he has this interview, and it's all about his experiences of it. And I'm just going to read you a couple of extracts here. The woman at Macy's asked, "Would you be interested in full-time elf or evening and weekend elf?" I said, "Full-time elf. I have an appointment next Wednesday at noon. I am a 33-year-old man applying for a job as an elf. I often see people on the streets dressed as objects and handing out leaflets. I tend to avoid leaflets, but it breaks my heart to see a grown man dressed as a taco. So if there is a costume involved, I tend not only to accept the leaflet, but also to accept it graciously, saying, 'Thank you so much,' and thinking, 'You poor, pathetic son of a bitch. I don't know what you've done, but I hope I never catch it. This afternoon on Lexington Avenue, I accepted a leaflet from a man dressed as a camcorder. Hot dog, peanuts, tacos, video cameras. These things make me sad because they just don't fit on the streets. In a parade, maybe, but not on the streets. I figure that at least as an elf, I will have a place. I'll be at Santa's village with all the other elves. We will reside in a fluffy wonderland, survived by candy canes and gingerbread shacks. I won't be quite as sad as standing on some street corner dressed as a French fry. I'm trying to look on the bright side. I arrived in New York 3 weeks ago with high hopes, hopes that have been challenged. In my imagination, I'd go straight from Penn Station to the offices of One Life to Live, where I would drop off my bags and spruce up before heading off for drinks with Cord Roberts and Victoria Buchanan, the show's greatest stars. We'd sit in a plush booth at a Tony cocktail lounge where my new celebrity friends would lift their frosty glasses in my direction and say, "A toast to David Sedaris, the best writer this show has ever had." He then goes on describing what it is like, the kind of training that you have as a to be an elf. We were given a lecture by the chief of security, who told us that Macy's Herald Square suffers millions of dollars worth of employee theft per year. As a result, the store treats its employees the way one might treat a felon with a long criminal record. Cash rewards are offered for turning people in, and our bags are searched every time we leave the store. We were then shown videotapes in which supposed former employees hang their heads and rue the day they ever thought to steal that leather jacket. The actors face the camera to explain how their arrests had ruined their friendships, family life, and ultimately their future. One fellow stared at his hands and sighed. "There's no way I'm going to be admitted to law school now. Not now. Not after what I've done. No, no way." He paused and shook his head of the unpleasant memory. "Oh, man, not after this. No way." And so it goes on, describing all of these different things. In the afternoon, we were given a tour of Santaland, which really is something. It's beautiful, a real wonderland with 10,000 sparkling lights, false snow, train sets, bridges, decorated trees, mechanical penguins and bears, and really tall candy canes. One enters and travels through a maze, a path which takes you from one festive environment to another. The path ends at the magic tree. The tree is supposed to resemble a complex system of roots, but actually looks like a scale model of the human intestinal tract. Once you pass the magic tree, the light dims and an elf guides you to Santa's house. The houses are cosy and intimate, clean, blah, 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 blah. We travelled the path a second time and were given the code names for the various posts, such as the Vomit Corner, a mirrored wall near the magic tree where nauseous children tend to surrender the contents of their stomachs. When someone vomits, the nearest elf is supposed to yell, "Vamoose!" which is the name of the janitorial product used by the store, presumably to clean up the child vomit. And so it goes on and on and on. I won't spoil any more. Go out, get a copy of this book, because it is excellent. You will not regret it.
Good stuff. Well, there you are, guys. There's some wonderful history of elves. Elves and elves. And the way you can think about them, but get rid of that elf on the shelf, it's evil. It's a bad thing to have. If you want to find out what's coming next, I'll tell you what's coming next. We're going to do a history of babies, which is about as Christmassy as you can get. But anyway, whatever else we're doing, do follow me on Twitter. I'm at Dr. Sam Willis. And if you like maritime and naval history in the sea, do please listen to the Mariner's Mirror podcast.
And you can follow me on Twitter at James Daybell. You can follow the podcast at Unexpected Pod on Twitter. We are also on Instagram and Facebook, so check us out there. Become friends. We also have a website, historiesoftheunexpected.com, with all sorts of things that we've been doing, and you can get little essays on related topics to all the episodes of our podcasts. And if you would like to help out and support what we're trying to do, then head over to Patreon and become a patron of Histories of the Unexpected. Anything that you can give to support us is very gratefully received. But meanwhile, hopefully you're enjoying a festive season.
Yes, I think we all are. Let's carry on enjoying it. We'll be back again with you soon, guys. Cheerio.
Bye, guys. Happy Christmas.